The human observer in this situation is itself a bioenergetic system of electromagnetic energy and photonic radiation. We are, in a very real sense, beacons of light. What I mean by this is quite simply that once I was in a state of heightened energy, positive energy, I began to very coherently lace real thoughts into this energetic feeling. So I would speak clearly in my mind about my desire to have contact, for my desire to connect with something, asking if they can hear me, if they can respond. So clear thoughts being embedded into what was now a more resonant energetic system. Plasma orb of sufficient ionic density could technically seed a micro cloud around itself in a process analogous to artificial cloud seeding. The transition from dark core to lighter, semi-transparent outer layers maps onto what plasma physicists describe in double-structured plasma configurations. A burning lantern will illuminate a wall, a drone's LED throws light onto the grass beneath it. The orbs that I witnessed, however, did none of this. Plasma begins to appear ghost-like and semi-transparent to the human eye, rather than brilliantly luminous, again drawing parallels to what I experienced with these orange orbs that didn't scatter any light onto the environment and did demonstrate this diffuse layering of darker orange in the center, coming out to a lighter orange on the periphery. There is published scientific discussion primarily from plasma physics, but increasingly also from the UFO-aligned research of plasma structures that exhibit what can only be described as adaptive behavior, altering their internal configuration in response to external electromagnetic inputs, changing shape, altering luminosity, and modifying their trajectory in ways that are inconsistent with a passive physical drifting atmospheric phenomenon. More radical research published in the Journal of Modern Physics in 2024 and 2025 argues that plasmoids filmed by NASA space shuttle missions in their thermosphere exhibit not merely self-organization, but what the authors described as lifelike behavior. It sounds completely insane, but if you just grapple with me here, I want to try and convince you that there are tangible, evidentiary pathways in science that are beginning to explain how something like this is even possible. It's not just magic, it's not just woo-woo. I really want you to get this, especially if you're a skeptic. Your deliberate, intentional, rhythmic breathing is a tool for activating deeper layers of the body's mechanisms. So again, not magic, science, not new age nonsense, biophysics. In August 2019, I had a series of paranormal experiences, phenomena beyond my comprehension or ability to categorize prosaically. These events occurred in direct correlation, it would appear, to my own conscious actions, which were of making genuine mental requests to experience something beyond the normal. These experiences, when they occurred, have in turn fueled my entire public career as a researcher. The avenues of interest that I've pursued intellectually and intuitively, which in turn translate into the public videos that I present to all of you, are in of themselves connected to an underlying desire for me to know what it was that I experienced in 2019. And this video is going to be focused on exploring the empirical, scientifically valid anchors that we have available to us that allow these extremely esoteric, mystical experiences to be, at the very least, enveloped within some form of rational framework that we can apply to the modern perception of the world and the scientific method that we adhere to. The issue I think a lot of people run into, myself included, when they have an incredible experience or set of experiences that for them is utterly life-changing, reality-shifting, perception-altering, they're no longer the same person to a certain degree. And this in of itself can cause that person, especially if they feel like they need to tell people what they experienced, to rush their explanations, use new age spiritual terms that make sense to them, unfortunately for the most part translate to those hearing these testimonies into the ravings of a woo-woo new age weirdo, right? A lot of people feel they can't express their experiences without being mocked, and I understand this because when I first had my experiences with these orange orbs of light, which I'll speak in more detail throughout this video on, I was to a certain degree made into a zealot, in the sense that I was so strong in my belief, in my conviction, that it came across to some of those closest to me, like my father, as radicalism bordering on mental illness. It took time. It took time for me to understand that it wasn't so much the experiences themselves that gave him pause or cause to doubt me, but it was my energy, my inability to articulate these experiences in a format that would be comfortable. It was my own failings in communication, because I was trying to get someone to understand these experiences from the same point of view that I had arrived at previously, that allowed me to have those experiences in the first place. But the problem is that my learning path towards eventually having those experiences consisted of several years of synchronicities and falling down rabbit holes in research that most people don't have the inclination to explore. And so to assume another person will have the same level of understanding as you when it comes to something as strange as orbs of light hovering over your house, when you get into meditative states of mind and project clear intentions into the universe that you desire to have contact with a higher form of intelligence, this is not the kind of dinner table conversation that people are accustomed to. My experiences involved orange orbs of light. It's the best way that I can describe them. Many of you will know this. Some of you may only now be finding this out, but it's actually the primary reason, the initial catalyst that pushed me towards going public about my own experiences and then going public with my research and then getting interviews and then, you know, fast forward a couple of years and I have a podcast. So it all came from the initial impetus to let people know that these experiences with orbs of light happened to me, and not only that they happened to me, but that they happened in what appeared to be a direct correspondence with my own desire, my set intentions for the evening, and my genuine attempts, which were apparently successful, to bring my body mind into an energized and highly positive state of emotion. And then imagine myself to be projecting these intentions, these energies, these emotions into the universe, with the underlying message being that I wanted something of a higher consciousness than my own to respond. And this is when orbs of light began arriving over my house. So let's talk about what I saw. And then we'll talk about the scientific explorations, the evidential pathways, the logic-based explanations that we might be able to use to bring some of these experiences into a clear picture of what could be possible. I'm still going to challenge your perception, some of you, because I know that these experiences were not prosaic. I'm not trying to debunk them. I know they are operating on some boundary layer of human understanding that we haven't quite crossed the threshold of. We don't know what they are. But as science evolves, we are entering into territories that may allow us to connect some of the dots, especially with the ancient mystic claims that actually seem to have gotten to the truth thousands of years before us without the tools of science. But the tools of modern science are refining themselves to the point where we can begin to use bleeding-edge experimental research as a means of pattern matching our own experiences and the experiences of those who came before us, which seem inherently mystical, and perhaps ultimately are, but are beginning to ground themselves into observable, repeatable discoveries in science, which invokes the more exotic possibilities of reality, and in a way, more importantly, human consciousness. And this is the primary point of discussion here, human consciousness, and whether or not it possesses the ability to perform actions that were once deemed magical, perhaps even fanciful, and are now coming closer to being observed as innate but dampened abilities within all of us. In a nutshell, what I experienced in 2019 were basketball-sized orange orbs of light, bearing no surface reflection and no external glow, with a darker, deeper core that graduated through progressively lighter, semi-transparent layers towards an outer boundary. They appeared in groups on four separate occasions, flying in formation. On one occasion, a large group of these orbs flying in a triangle formation generated what appeared to be a self-produced static-like cloud as a form of obscurement, which then dissipated as if on command. I'm being serious. I also experienced three of these orbs descending slowly in a rotating mutual orbit before freezing silently above the roof of my house. The orbs appeared specifically and repeatedly in direct correlation with a practice of deliberate, emotionally charged, logically coherent mental projection, is the best way to put it, projecting my intentions. A still mind from which positive emotional energy was raised up and woven into conscious intention before being directed outward as an invitation. It sounds completely insane, but if you just grapple with me here, I want to try and convince you that there are tangible, evidentiary pathways in science that are beginning to explain how something like this is even possible. It's not just magic. It's not just woo-woo. Stay with me here. So we're going to look at my own experiences and the wider history of similar experiences through a multi-layered framework. We're going to draw on plasma biophysics, quantum biology, consciousness physics, government-documented UFO research, ancient esoteric traditions, and theoretical physics, not to arrive at a single answer, but to construct the most honest and intelligent map possible of what this phenomenon might be, and why a human engaged in coherent heart-brain entrainment might be the catalyst for its appearance. The closest I ever came to these orbs was during the third out of the four contact events. Three of them came down from the sky in a rotational orbit around each other, before abruptly freezing a few feet above the roof of my house. They went from a smooth, gradual rotational descent to a complete standstill. And something I noticed was the lack of surface reflection onto the surrounding environment. So there was no light scattering from the orbs onto the roof of the house, despite them being apparently made of light and being only a few feet above the roof of the house. They should logically be illuminating the environment, but the orbs themselves did not glow. They did not radiate light in the typical sense. They seemed almost ghost-like, ethereal. The specific optical properties of these orbs are actually very important because conventional light-emitting objects, fire, plasma torches, hot gases, incandescent filaments, all produce light through emissions that radiate outward and inevitably interact with the surrounding surfaces through reflection and refraction and scattering. A burning lantern will illuminate a wall, a drone's LED throws light onto the grass beneath it. The orbs that I witnessed, however, did none of this. A deeper orange core that transitions progressively to lighter, more transparent concentric layers with no external glow whatsoever and no surface reflections in the surrounding environment describes something physically unusual, but not beyond the realms of the possible. In fact, we actually have observations in modern science that may even help us understand what these orbs consist of. Ball lightning literature, which is the closest conventional phenomena to match my own experiences, describes objects that typically do cast light onto their surroundings and leave optical traces, but the orbs I witnessed appeared to violate this basic radiative property, which suggests either that what is being perceived as light is not actually a photonic emission in the conventional electromagnetic sense, or that there exists some form of field confinement mechanism at the outer boundary of the structure that prevents photonic escape beyond a certain radius. Now, one candidate for such a mechanism comes from plasma physics. In magnetized plasma structures, the magnetic pressure at the periphery of a confined plasma can create what are called separatrix boundaries, surfaces where the field topology changes abruptly and particles cannot cross. If such a boundary was sufficiently stable and magnetically sharp, it could theoretically confine the photonic emissions of the plasma interior. The transition from dark core to lighter, semi-transparent outer layers maps onto what plasma physicists describe in double-structured plasma configurations, a denser, hotter inner core where ionization and recombination are generating electromagnetic emission, surrounded by progressively cooler, lower-density plasma where the emission spectrum shifts in the orange to red range and becomes more diffuse. The orange coloration is actually consistent with the emission spectra of low-temperature plasma at around 1500 to 2500 Kelvin. The precise range at which plasma begins to appear ghost-like and semi-transparent to the human eye, rather than brilliantly luminous. Again, drawing parallels to what I experienced with these orange orbs that didn't scatter any light onto the environment, and did demonstrate this diffuse layering of darker orange in the center, coming out to a lighter orange on the periphery. Very similar to what they're describing in these exotic high-energy plasma physics experiments. However, there is also a secondary possibility that deserves serious consideration, that the light perceived is not photonic in origin at all, but is instead a manifestation of what might be called biological optical perception of a field phenomenon. Fritz Albert Popp's biophoton research established that living living organisms emit coherent, ultra-weak photonic radiation from DNA and cellular structures. If the perceiving consciousness is itself a biophotonic system, and the evidence is clear now that the human system is absolutely biophotonic in nature, then it's conceivable that what is being registered as orange light is a direct quantum-level interaction between the observer's biophotonic field and the electromagnetic signature of the orb, perceived as color because the human visual cortex has no other framework through which to interpret such input. So in that model, the orb's apparent light would not be photons emitted outward, but would be a field resonance being perceived inwardly, which would elegantly explain the absence of surface reflection and external glow, while preserving the subjective vividness of the visual experience. Another important element of these experiences came with the first ever encounter I had with the orbs of light. All of these encounters took place in my back garden, at nighttime, in the summer of 2019, during the month of August. The first encounter involved me observing a single cloud in an otherwise clear night sky. Upon closer observation, I noticed that this cloud had an extremely strange appearance to it. It was subtle and was only apparent if you decided to pay close attention to the cloud. But it was exhibiting an effect I can only describe as staticky, as if a light overlay of TV static was surrounding the cloud. In other words, you could say it looked as if there was an active field around it, something shimmering or agitated, tiny particles moving very quickly, producing this static-like appearance around the cloud. This cloud then proceeded to perform an extremely abrupt right-angle turn and was now drifting directly towards me. Previously, it was moving laterally, as if it was going to go right past my house. As it got in alignment with my house, high up in the sky, but in alignment with my house, and I'm at the back of my garden, looking towards this cloud as it's moving sideways, it literally did that. Towards me. It flipped and did a 90-degree turn. Now it's moving towards me. I was frozen in place, not so much with fear, but with absolute confusion and shock at seeing this cloud perform what can only be viewed as an intelligently controlled and highly abrupt maneuver. Once the cloud was directly above my head, it dissipated in less than 1 second, and it did so by shrinking into a central point, as if a vacuum in the center had sucked it all back inside. And as this happened, as the cloud was removed, it revealed a large formation of roughly 25 to 30 orange orbs of light in a perfect triangle formation. This revealing occurred directly above my head. I was craning my neck up to the sky, looking up at this cloud as this action was performed and the formation was revealed. The formation didn't loiter, it continued moving on behind me. I had to turn around and look as it went off into the distance, and as it was moving away, I noticed that some of the orbs in this triangle formation were actually swapping positions within it, which solidified in my mind that this was not a large triangle-shaped vehicle, of which I was only seeing the underside lights, but was in fact a formation of individual orb-like probes or beings or animals or spirits, right? Who knows? I had no idea what they are, other than the fact that I was certain we don't have a rational, widely accepted explanation for their existence. The capacity of the orbs to generate what appears to be a self-produced static-like cloud around themselves, one that can rapidly dissipate to reveal this formation of orbs beneath, is a pretty extraordinary feature. One possibility is that this behavior suggests a form of active environmental manipulation at the micro scale, the ability to locally ionize, charge, and coalesce atmospheric water vapor and aerosol particles into a pseudo cloud, like a fake cloud formation, and then rapidly discharge or redistribute the charge to clear the surrounding air. And that mechanism does have a plausible physical basis. Plasma objects are surrounded by an ionic corona, a zone of excited and ionized gas that can promote the condensation of water vapor, for example, by providing charged nucleation. So in sufficiently humid atmospheric conditions, a plasma orb of sufficient ionic density could technically seed a micro cloud around itself in a process analogous to artificial cloud seeding, but operating at the scale of centimeters rather than kilometers. The dissipation of such a cloud would follow if the orb rapidly changed its ionic output, redistributed the charge, expanded its magnetic boundary to dissipate the localized nucleation. This might all sound really intense and perhaps hard to believe, but we are entering into the realms within science of discussing in serious tones the possibility of sentient plasma, plasmic intelligences. And if they do exist, and if these orbs are examples of their existence, then all of these extremely exotic sounding abilities, you know, the controlling of the local environment by increasing or decreasing their charge states, well, for a plasmic intelligence, this could be as simple as flexing a muscle for a human. If we're dealing with a plasma-based intelligence, then there's no reason to doubt that such an intelligence can use its own system to perform intelligent actions, right? And since these are actions available to benign plasma as mere consequence of their nature, an actual self-aware plasma may be capable of using these abilities at will. What makes the self-generated cloud phenomena stranger? It's not just the fact that the cloud forms and then dissipates, it's that it appears to do so with apparent intent and timing, performing this action directly above my head, revealing its true nature to me before leaving. This introduces the possibility that whatever controls the internal charge distribution and field boundary of those orbs is doing so responsively, responding either to environmental conditions or quite possibly to the attention of me, the observer. Keep in mind, and we will get deeper into this, but keep in mind, the human observer in this situation is itself a bioenergetic system of electromagnetic energy and photonic radiation. We are, in a very real sense, beacons of light. Perhaps something of an energetic nature can be drawn to our energetic output. There is published scientific discussion primarily from plasma physics, but increasingly also from the UFO-aligned research of plasma structures that exhibit what can only be described as adaptive behavior, altering their internal configuration in response to external electromagnetic inputs, changing shape, altering luminosity, and modifying their trajectory in ways that are inconsistent with a passive physical drifting atmospheric phenomena. Plasmas as a fourth domain of life, published in the Journal of Modern Physics, analyzed NASA space shuttle thermospheric footage and identified plasmoid entities accelerating to velocities of up to 356 kilometers per second, making abrupt 163-degree turns and demonstrating apparent mutual awareness and group coordination. Sounds very similar to what I experienced myself. The cloud generation capability that I experienced in my encounter actually fits precisely with this paradigm of adaptive plasma behavior. The cloud is not a passive byproduct, but a functional feature, perhaps a sensor dampening mechanism, perhaps a social communication signal between the orbs, perhaps a form of phase modulation that allows the orbs to exist partially in one state of matter field interaction and partially in another. One foot in this reality, another foot somewhere else. I would argue that the most materially grounded of the hypotheses on offer is that these orbs represent a class of self-organized plasma entity, what some researchers have begun calling plasmoids. These are distinct from conventional plasma physics, but operate within known physical parameters, albeit at extremes that are not yet fully mapped. The core of this hypothesis is that plasma, the fourth state of matter, comprising approximately 99% of the observable universe, by the way, if you didn't know that, plasma comprises 99% of the observable universe. We're taught about solids, we're taught about liquids, we're taught about gases in very early years of school. Don't really get much mention of plasma, even though, again, 99% of the observable universe is comprised of it. But the core of this hypothesis is that this plasma is not merely ionized gas, but is in fact an energetic medium capable of extraordinary self-organization that in sufficiently complex configurations may support something analogous to intelligent behavior. Research published in scientific papers of the Russian Academy of Sciences and extended in recent peer-reviewed work has demonstrated that dusty plasma crystals, plasma containing charged particulate matter, can form ordered lattice structures, exhibit memory-like behavior, and communicate state changes across spatial separations through electromagnetic signaling. More radical research published in the Journal of Modern Physics in 2024 and 2025 argues that plasmoids filmed by NASA space shuttle missions in their thermosphere exhibit not merely self-organization, but what the authors described as lifelike behavior, a defined cellular nucleus, double membrane layers analogous to biological cell walls, replication through fission-like splitting, apparent communication through luminosity oscillations, mutual awareness in collision events where entities alter trajectory before contact. The paper goes as far to argue that plasmoids represent a fourth domain of life. Life organized not around carbon-based chemistry, but around electromagnetic field coherence in plasma. The grouping in formations, the rotating around each other during the descent, and the freezing in position above my roof demonstrates there's certainly some form of mutual trajectory awareness, some form of coordinated motion, the capacity to instantaneously change from moving to completely still. That's a behavior that has no analog in conventional gas dynamics or aerodynamic objects or ball lightning, but it does make complete sense if the entity is field confined rather than physically bounded, as well as being potentially under a form of intentional, even intelligent control. If these are natural atmospheric entities, why do they seem to appear in correspondence to a human observer performing specific mental practices? One answer is that they're not operating from nowhere or traveling vast distances or entering through dimensional rifts, but are in fact nearby and perhaps normally in a state that renders them undetectable to the human eye. It could be that the electromagnetic output associated with the coherent heart-brain practices of a human being entering meditative states of consciousness may itself be creating a local field perturbation that either attracts these orbs or plasma beings to the location or triggers them into a visible emission state. I've compared this before to the behavior of small fish nibbling the salt from our toes. If these are plasmic entities and if they gain some form of sustenance through absorption of electromagnetic radiation, which is something that has even been studied in a major multi-institution peer-reviewed research endeavor into sentient plasma phenomena in the upper atmosphere, a study involving NASA and other major names. I did a video on that study previously, and a link for that will be in the description box of this video. Maybe tickle that subscribe button while you're there. Just saying.
Just saying.
So what we could be looking at is a form of plasma entity that is normally in a low energy, low emission state, which can then become visible to the naked eye when a strong, coherent electromagnetic field enters its environment. The orb becomes visible not because it arrives, but because it lights up in response to a specific frequency of environmental electromagnetic coherence, one that a human being is capable of producing and in turn exciting or agitating these energetic phenomena into the visible light spectrum. I think understanding why the specific practices of stillness, emotional elevation, emotional logical entanglement, projected intention from within the human mind might function as a catalyst for the appearance of these orbs, it requires understanding what is actually being generated by the human body during such a state. Because I'm not here to invoke magic and convince you of special powers that only I or a few other people have. Not at all. I want to look at this through a lens that can be appreciated by a scientific mind, because I am actually, for the most part, a scientific mind. I am a logical thinker who has had illogical events occur to him that forced him to recognize his logic was too limiting and needed to be expanded into areas I previously considered illogical, but now no longer do. And now my intention is to bring you to the same point of understanding by using logic to bring the illogical into a clearer vision of the possible. How am I doing so far? The research of the Heart Math Institute accumulated over more than 3 decades, and now documented in peer-reviewed publication, has established that the human heart generates the strongest electromagnetic field in the body, orders of magnitude stronger than the brain, and that this field carries encoded emotional and intentional information that radiates outward and is measurable at a distance of several feet around the body. When a person enters what heart math researchers call cardiac coherence, a state of ordered, smooth, high-amplitude heart rate variability associated specifically with sustained positive emotional states such as love and care and gratitude and compassion, the electromagnetic field of the heart transitions from chaotic, incoherent radiation to a stable, ordered waveform This is not a trivial distinction. A coherent electromagnetic field is a fundamentally different physical phenomenon from an incoherent one. An incoherent field is noise. It contains all frequencies at random phases and magnitudes, carrying no information that can be extracted by a receiver tuned to a specific frequency. A coherent field is a signal. It has structure and the capacity to resonate with other systems that share its characteristic frequency. And so the practice that I was engaged in when attempting to make a form of contact with other intelligences in our wider reality, they began from getting myself into a state of mental stillness through calm breathwork, which again, remove the idea of woo-woo magic and New Age rhetoric, okay? Look at calm breathwork as a literal biohacking mechanism for changing the way your body behaves on the microcellular level. Your deliberate, intentional, rhythmic breathing is a tool for activating deeper layers of the body's mechanisms. So again, not magic, science, not New Age nonsense, biophysics. So once you are in that place of mental stillness, you begin deliberately cultivating positive emotional energy and interweaving it with logical, directed intention. What does that mean? Well, it means that you think good thoughts. You think about what you are grateful for, what you love, because as we all know, this makes us feel a certain way. And again, not magic, biophysics. You are literally energizing your body through positive emotions. And I do mean literally because, as we just covered, we have demonstrable evidence that positive emotion increases the amplitude of your electromagnetic field, increases not only the intensity, but the coherence of that field. Okay, so stay with me here because I really want you to get this, especially if you're a skeptic. I've said what cultivating a positive emotional energy means, but I also said that you interweave that energy with logical directed intention. What I mean by this is quite simply that once I was in a state of heightened energy, positive energy, I began to very coherently lace real thoughts into this energetic feeling. So I would speak clearly in my mind about my desire to have contact, for my desire to connect with something, asking if they can hear me, if they can respond. So clear thoughts being embedded into what was now a more resonant energetic system, because I've been raising my emotions, right? The human body in a state of emotionally energized excitation. This energy is leaving your body. It's entering the wider energetic mediums surrounding us in our environment. And this energy leaving your body is no longer noise. It is not chaotic output. It is coherent. You, through your mind, through your thoughts, through your emotions, you are turning that energy into coherent signals. You are embedding within that energy linguistic thought patterns. You are repeating in your mind your desires for contact, for communication. They are ingrained into the energy that you are then outputting. Okay? So if you receive responses from something while in this state, we have to say at least it's possible that a form of paranormal response to these actions has occurred because some form of intelligence was capable of literally understanding the energy you were outputting. How that's possible, I have no idea. It has somehow the capability to translate the logic-based thought sequences that you've embedded into that energy you were putting out. I want contact, I want communication, I want to connect with something. And it was able to understand this and then respond in kind. And the implications of that are in of themselves profound beyond measure. Fritz Albert Popp's work on biophoton emissions does add another layer to this picture, because Popp demonstrated that every living cell emits these ultra-weak coherent photons from DNA, not random thermal emission, but ordered, phase-correlated light. Healthy organisms emit more coherent biophoton signals than diseased ones. The more coherent the biological system, the more coherent its biophotonic output. A practitioner in deep cardiac coherence with both the heart's electromagnetic field and the body's biophotonic system in a state of maximum coherence would be radiating a combined electromagnetic photonic field of extraordinary structure. Not loud in terms of power, but crystalline in terms of informational content. If a plasma entity capable of detecting and responding to electromagnetic coherence were within range, this signal would be immediately distinguishable from background electromagnetic noise. It would be, in the most literal sense, a beacon or a signal. The Advanced Aerospace Weapons System Application Program, ORSAP, the $22 million classified Defense Intelligence Agency program operating through Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies, documented in its 494-page comprehensive phenomenology report exactly this kind of consciousness-correlated UAP or UFO response. This pattern of observer awareness was also documented in the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory working on consciousness-machine interaction, where human intention was found to produce statistically significant effects on quantum random event generators, small but consistent enough across millions of trials to be experimentally undeniable. If the human practitioner is generating a coherent bioelectromagnetic signal that serves as a contact beacon, the deeper question then becomes how intention, a purely interior, non-physical state, becomes embedded in that signal in a way that a receiving entity could detect and interpret as a contact request. The Penrose-Hameroff Orchestrated Objective Reduction Theory, or ORC-OR for short, is a model that provides a framework where this may be explained. Penrose and Hameroff argue that consciousness is not a product of classical neural computation, but that consciousness arises from quantum computations in microtubules within brain neurons. Microtubules are these microscopic subunits of protein that are arranged in a helical structure present in the billions inside of our neurons within the brain. And they're becoming a point of strong evidence as a possible antenna for consciousness, the receiving nodes through which what we call consciousness is rendered into being. In simple terms, ORC-OR suggests that tiny structures inside our brain's cells called microtubules may act like microscopic quantum processors. At this incredibly small scale, particles can temporarily exist in several possible states at once. According to the theory, huge numbers of these quantum possibilities become organized inside the microtubules until they reach a critical point and suddenly collapse into one definite state. Penrose and Hameroff propose that each of these collapses creates a tiny frame or moment of conscious experience. Billions of these coordinated events happening continuously across the brain would then combine like individual frames of a movie to produce the seamless stream of awareness we call consciousness. The particularly radical part of the theory is Penrose's suggestion that these quantum collapses may be connected to the fundamental structure of space-time itself, that these quantum possibilities percolate up from the foundation of reality, are collected by our microtubule architecture, and then collapsed into one definitive state, and this happens continuously on the order of billions of computations per second across the entire microtubule network in your brain. And if this is accurate, then it suggests consciousness itself arises from, well, the foundations of reality itself, up into your mind and rendered into what we call being a human being, rather than simply being a generated and temporary phenomena of the brain. Again, this is the mystic insight, right? This is the mystic insight from thousands of years ago, the spiritual knowledge meeting the scientific evidence in the modern era, unifying what were once differing perspectives of science and spirituality into a form of cohesive, symbiotic model for viewing fundamental reality and our connection to it.
The microtubules themselves, they're inside neurons. They're made of proteins called tubulin, these peanut-shaped proteins that self-assemble into microtubules, and there's about a billion tubulins per neuron, and, you know, depending on hundreds, let's say, of microtubules, and they'd be switching, let's say, at 10 megahertz, so a billion times 10 megahertz is about 10 to the 16th ops per second, which they were saying was for the whole brain. So that was before I met Roger, and then when we tried to turn it into a quantum model, we were immediately faced with the idea that everybody knew, they turned out to be wrong, everybody knew that the brain was too warm, wet, and noisy for delicate quantum effects, because if you want to build a quantum computer in a laboratory, you have to do it at absolute zero temperature to avoid decoherence, vibrations. But Roger and I thought, well, biology's had a billion years to, or however long, I guess 3.5 billion, to figure it out, and so there must be a mechanism. Although now I've kind of changed my mind and think that consciousness didn't evolve in biology, that consciousness was there first and prompted the origin of life, but that's another story. So we had to deal with the criticism and you know, rebuttals from people. Well, everybody knows it's too warm and noisy. And Max Tegmark wrote this infamous paper calculating that the microtubules would decohere in 10 to the minus 13 seconds, way too fast for anything useful biologically. But he made a mistake of 7 orders of magnitude, and it turned out we recalculated using the same formula published in the same journal. And it was more like 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th, which we've now shown quantum effects that duration. You know, but the damage was done, and I still hear from people say, well, Tegmark refuted you guys, you know, back in 2001 or 2000. And I go, no, he didn't. We refuted that, but nobody read the refutation. And so anyway, that was a big damper. But then in 2006, people began to find quantum effects in photosynthesis in plants. And in sunlight.
And in magnetoreception in birds, right?
That too, right. So there was quantum going on, and but it was, people said, yeah, okay, a little tiny quantum, but not the whole brain like you guys want. So, yeah, skepticism continued. But in the last, since photosynthesis, in the last 15, whatever, almost 20 years, quantum effects have been shown, all kinds of quantum effects, including what you just said, the bird navigation and following the magnetic field, and many others, including anesthesia, which acts by quantum effects only and is specific for consciousness.
Bringing this information into the conversation about making a form of contact with other intelligences in reality, we can see how if each moment of conscious intention involves a quantum collapsing event that is literally entangled with Planck-scale space-time geometry, then a sufficiently ordered, high-amplitude sequence of such events, being done consciously by the human being, is precisely the kind that would be generated by a meditative practitioner in deep, coherent, intentional focus, and would constitute a physically real perturbation of local space-time geometry, something that would rise above the ambient noise floor, a signal emanating from you, coherent and intentional. Complementing the Ork-OR theory, the torsion field hypothesis developed by Russian physicists Kozvriev, Shipov, and Akimov proposes that spinning and vibrating matter, and notably consciousness itself, generates a torsion wave, a spiral distortion of the space-time metric that propagates instantaneously or at velocities far exceeding the speed of light and carries information without carrying energy. Professor Kozriev documented physical measurement effects caused by sudden physiological changes in human observers, suggesting that consciousness generates a physically detectable torsion signature. Shipov's equations connect torsion dynamics to the physical vacuum, and Akimov's experimental work indicated that torsion generators could actually reproduce effects that were previously observed only in experiments with psychically gifted individuals, implying that human consciousness and artificial torsion generation are interchangeable in their effects on matter. Rupert Sheldrake's morphic resonance theory provides another dimension. Sheldrake proposes that self-organizing systems, from crystals to organisms to even social groups, are shaped by morphic fields that carry an inherent memory derived from all previous occurrences of similar systems. These fields are not stored anywhere physically, they operate through direct resonance across time and space, meaning that the very act of successfully initiating contact on one occasion would strengthen the morphic field pattern associated with that practice, making subsequent contact more probable. The orbs of light, in morphic field terms, may have developed their own resonance-based familiarity that makes the contact easier to establish on each iteration. The timing of the orb's appearance with deliberate conscious intention, the rotating descent and stationary hovering above my roof, the semi-transparent ghost-like quality, all of these features sit comfortably within what Jacques Vallée, one of the most rigorous scientific analysts of UAP phenomena across a 60-year career, has termed the paraphysical model and the control system hypothesis. Vallée's central argument, developed across multiple books, is that the UAP and orb phenomenon is not consistent with extraterrestrial spacecraft in any conventional sense, but is rather evidence of an intelligence that coexists with human consciousness. likely terrestrial in origin rather than interstellar, that has been interacting with human beings across all of recorded history, adapting its apparent form to the dominant cultural and technological paradigm of each era. In medieval accounts, for example, it was often angelic light. And then in the late 19th century, it was exotic airships. In the 20th century, it became flying saucers and elliptical craft. But beneath these shining surfaces, Vallée identifies a constant structural fingerprint, the presence of light phenomena, the induction of altered consciousness states in witnesses, the apparent responsiveness to direct human attention, and the use of what he calls high strangeness, absurdity, and transphysical behavior. Things that don't mesh with what we understand about reality, and yet are happening regardless of whether you believe in them or not. All of this being done, in Vallée's opinion, as a mechanism for disrupting the observer, you or me, disrupting the observer's consensus reality framework and expanding their conceptual boundaries. I mean, I certainly believe that this is what occurred for me when I had my experiences, even though the orbs of light aren't the most outrageous experience that you could have. I mean, many people have given testimonies of far stranger and more visceral and sometimes even more terrifying experiences. What it offered me was a step above the plateau of reality that I'd become accustomed to. It was a sudden curve up, matching me in reality, so not just theoretical, but physical, practical, actually observable, and yet it was a contradiction of what I understood to be real. And so my brain had to, I suppose, either refuse to believe that it even happened to me and just forget about it, or accept it. And by accepting it, you then take a form of a step up in your perception, right? The aperture, the corridor of your knowledge begins to expand. Your willingness to accept things in reality is expanded because you've had a novel experience, and you know, you can't then deny it occurred. So if you have a novel experience, it does allow you, I suppose, to widen your sense of what is possible in reality. One of Jacques Vallée's collaborators and a parallel theorist, John Keel, developed into what he called the ultra-terrestrial model and the superspectrum hypothesis. Keel argued that the entities behind UFO phenomena are not spacefaring aliens, but are native intelligences composed of energy, residing in the upper frequency ranges of a spectrum that encompasses both electromagnetic and non-electromagnetic field phenomena. These intelligences, in Keel's opinion, would not cross dimensional barriers. Rather, they modulate their frequency to intersect with the band of reality that humans occupy, visible light, matter interaction, when they choose to manifest. Every significant esoteric and mystical tradition on the planet contains accounts of intentionally summoned light entities, and the descriptions bear striking resemblance to the phenomena that I experienced. I don't think that this is incidental. If consciousness genuinely has the physical properties assigned to it by the HeartMath Research Institute through the torsion field theories and orchestrated objective reduction, if it genuinely generates coherent fields that interact with plasma intelligence or ultra-terrestrial entities, then the traditions that developed rigorous practices for working with these interactions would naturally have encountered and documented them. The Tibetan Buddhist tradition of Dzogchen contains perhaps the most sophisticated framework for understanding the relationship between consciousness and light phenomena. The ultimate fruition of Togal practice, a form of non-dual awareness meditation, is the rainbow body, the transformation of the practitioner's physical form into light upon death. The Dzogchen system describes the fundamental nature of reality not as solid matter, but as spontaneous self-radiance. The universe is intrinsically luminous, and what appears as solid matter is a densification of the base luminosity that constitutes awareness itself. Phenomena that appear as balls of colored light are, in this Tibetan framework, not anomalies but glimpses of reality's actual nature, the base luminosity made temporarily visible through a thinning of the ordinary perceptual filters that maintain consensus material reality. The Tibetan Bon tradition, even older than Buddhist Dzogchen, and from which the rainbow body practice derives, describes specific entities called Sal, lights of awareness, that manifest as external luminous phenomena when a practitioner's internal awareness reaches a sufficient degree of coherence. These orbs of light, these light phenomena, are not considered to be supernatural intrusions, but are described as reflections or refractions of the practitioner's own consciousness encountering the luminous substrate of reality. The orange-gold light range is specifically associated in Tibetan color symbolism with the element of fire transformed. Not destructive fire, but the inner heat of tummo, the subtle fire of awakened awareness, which in advanced practitioners is described as generating perceptible warmth and light both within and outside the body. This has also been demonstrated in laboratory conditions. The Western esoteric tradition offers the concept of the tulpa, a thought form that can, under sufficient concentrated intention, manifest as a perceivable physical phenomenon. The Tibetan explorer Alexandra David Neal documented her own inadvertent creation of what she claims was a visible, initially benign entity through sustained, concentrated imagination during her time in Tibet. Sufficiently coherent, sustained, and emotionally charged intentional focus can produce a local condensation of the zero-point field or plasma or torsion field substrate into a briefly stable visible form. In this model, the orbs may not entirely be external entities, but are partly co-created. The practitioner's coherent signal doesn't just attract or summon a pre-existing entity, but actively participates in the entity's materialization by providing the energetic template around which the plasma or field structure self-organizes. And I don't think that that necessarily diminishes the reality of the phenomenon. I think it actually deepens it. It suggests that the boundary between the observer, me or you, and the observed is genuinely permeable at the level of quantum field dynamics. Guillo Tononi's integrated information theory of consciousness, while primarily developed as a framework for understanding biological consciousness, has profound implications for understanding whether plasma entities could support genuine consciousness. It proposes that consciousness is identical to integrated information, the capacity of a system to generate information as a whole that exceeds the sum of the information generated by its parts. This is quantified as pi, and crucially, integrated information theory claims that any physical system with non-zero pi has some degree of consciousness. The theory doesn't just restrict consciousness to biological nervous systems, it assigns consciousness wherever sufficient information integration occurs, which is why plasma could be invoked within this theory as a potential candidate for novel, energetically derived consciousness. A sufficiently complex plasma entity, one with internal structure, adaptive behavior, collective dynamics linking multiple components, and the capacity to alter its internal state in response to environmental information, would, under the integrated information theory, possess non-zero pi and therefore non-zero consciousness. The specific behaviors documented in thermospheric plasmoid research, again going back to the multi-institute NASA study, there's a link in the description box for the video where I covered that, where they're looking at the self-organizing properties of upper atmosphere plasma and its behavioral traits that suggest a level of intellect, a level of, even if animalistic, intelligent movement and intelligent decision-making. The orbs that I encountered in my own experiences exhibited all of the same types of behaviors. They were flying in group formations. They came down rotating before freezing above the roof of my house. In response to a specific human interaction, a human state of mind on multiple independent occasions, all consistent within the integrated information theory with a high pi system that's processing information from its environment, including the electromagnetic information broadcast by a human practitioner in cardiac brain coherence. Again, going back to amplifying your energetic output, your electromagnetic radiation, your biophotonic output, and creating a more coherent signal. These things are clearly able to, or at least it would seem they are able to, pick up on these above ambient spikes in the noise floor of the general surrounding environment. And I would honestly say that the panpsychist implication of integrated information theory is kind of relevant here. If consciousness is a fundamental property of any sufficiently information-integrated system, then the question of whether these orbs are conscious is not a question about exotic metaphysics, but about physics, specifically about whether their internal organization crosses the threshold of integrated information that associates with experience and consciousness. Frankly, the evidence seems to suggest that it does. And if these entities are conscious, genuinely experiencing information processing subjects, then my encounters are not merely visual spectacles, but they're a genuine meeting of minds. And I wonder if that was actually the case and whether or not I just kind of messed up my interactions, because to be honest, when they happened, I was just in a state of complete awe, shock and awe. I didn't have any intellectual thoughts to send off once they actually turned up. Each time. One of the most important developments in the 21st century has been the emergence of quantum biology as a legitimate research field, documenting that biological systems routinely exploit quantum mechanical phenomena in warm, wet, metabolically active environments, which were previously thought to be completely incompatible with quantum coherence. So you have photosynthesis in green plants and bacteria, which has been shown to achieve near 100% energy transfer efficiency using quantum coherent transport systems, quantum wave-like propagation of energy through photosynthetic complexes that explores multiple pathways simultaneously and then selects the most efficient one. This has been demonstrated. Again, this is now in a biological system that we previously thought was too much of a warm, wet, chaotic, noisy environment for quantum coherence to take place. Typically, quantum coherence was known to take place at extremely cold temperatures, way, way colder than a biological system would be able to produce. And yet, here we see, at least in plant life, they are tapping into these quantum abilities to transfer energy. And it's not just plant life. Avian magnetoreception, the ability of migratory birds to detect Earth's magnetic field, this operates through quantum entanglement sustained in what are called radical pairs within the cryptochrome molecules of the bird's eye. Scientists have measured entanglement coherence times within these birds in tens of microseconds, which is far longer than had ever been thought possible in a biological system. Migratory birds literally tap into quantum entanglement properties in combination with the Earth's magnetic field. I mean, that's the kind of thing that sounds like science fiction, like woo-woo psychic behavior, right? That they're somehow tapping into the Earth's magnetic field and they're matching it in their own brain, entanglement and information sharing, so that they naturally just know where to go, like an inbuilt sat-nav, like an inbuilt satellite navigation system, but it's the Earth's magnetic information informing them through a form of energetic interface that's just entanglement naturally. They don't have to do anything about it, it's just happening naturally. This is like a science fiction telepathic type of ability, but it's being demonstrated and proven in science in birds. Then you have enzyme catalysis, which achieves its extraordinary reaction rates through quantum tunneling of protons and electrons through energy barriers that classical chemistry says they cannot cross. And yet here they are crossing those barriers using quantum states to do so. Because if you remember, on the quantum level, things can exist in two places at once. They can exist in multiple areas of space and time. They can influence each other across massive, relatively speaking, distances in space and time. These spooky connections, something that Einstein called spooky action at a distance, this weird, uncanny ability for things to affect other things when they're not connected to each other and they're separated across distances. And so the entire concept here in regards to enzyme catalysis and quantum tunneling is that the enzymes are using quantum processes to pass through barriers that a physical, classical structure would not be able to pass through. It's essentially like saying, I throw a tennis ball at this wall and it bounces off. But then when I'm doing what the enzyme's doing, I throw a tennis ball at this wall and it passes right through it. Okay, so that's what the enzyme is doing in that situation. It's hacking through the material by going underneath it through quantum tunneling. Our previous models for reality and consciousness literally refused this as a possibility, and now it's proven. And essentially what all of this establishes is that the human body is not a purely classical system. It is a quantum system. It is a quantum biological system in which coherence and entanglement and tunneling play functional roles. And unlike a bird or an enzyme or a plant, we are, let's be fair, a much more complex conscious system, right? So if a bird can use electromagnetoreception and quantum entanglement, and if an enzyme can use quantum tunneling, I'm pretty sure a human consciously, intentionally can access the same quantum toolkit, but with a purpose behind it, instead of just being a natural automatic response of nature, right? Because that seems to be the case for at least the enzymes and the plant life and the birds. They're following their natural path in nature, whereas we've kind of broken out of that, or at least we're in a very novel expression of nature that looks like it's broken out of it because we do so much damage to it. Instead of living symbiotically, we're very far outside of the symbiosis of the planet, and yet we are these quantum biological systems. And so again, I'm just going to say, if a bird can do it and a plant can do it and an enzyme can do it, I'm pretty sure you can do it and you can do it better. If a bird's eye can maintain quantum entanglement long enough to detect the geomagnetic field, it's not implausible that a human brain in a state of deep meditative coherence with the orchestrated objective reduction microtubule quantum states potentially extended and stabilized by that coherent practice that you're engaged in could generate a quantum coherent output that is literally detectable at a distance by another quantum coherent system. The human heart adds a further dimension to this because the Heart Math Institute has documented that the heart's electromagnetic field, when it's in a coherent state, is registered not only in the brainwaves of individuals near the field generator, but in the physiological parameters of people at distances beyond physical proximity, with synchronization effects being observed between individual heart rhythms when they enter a state of empathic attunement. The Global Coherence Initiative has found correlations between geomagnetic field variations and global collective human emotional states, suggesting that the aggregate electromagnetic output of large numbers of coherently organized human biofields is actually sufficient to influence the geomagnetic environment measurably. If collective human coherence affects the geomagnetic field, the coherent output of a single practitioner in an intense state of focused positive emotional intention is certainly sufficient to perturb the local electromagnetic environment in ways that a sensitive plasma entity, for example, may be able to register. The specific choreography of my most dramatic encounter, the three orbs descending from the sky, rotating around each other in this mutual orbit and descending slowly in what feels like a coordinated movement, and then freezing a few feet above the roof of my house, I think it's important because I think it contains information about the nature of the entities. The very fact that these phenomena were rotating in some form of mutual orbit as they were descending down is not a behavior that any known conventional object would exhibit naturally. It does require each entity in the group to maintain a specific velocity and relativity to the other, coordinating in some form of trajectory continuously as they descend. That, to me, is indicative of intelligent control. And to arrive at a mutually agreed stopping point, all of them froze at the exact same time. Like, this feels to me like something was controlling potentially each individual orb as one singular intelligence. Drawing together the physics, the consciousness research, the documented UAP patterns, and the esoteric traditions, I would say that the most intellectually honest position is that no single framework is sufficient, and that the truth of this phenomenon likely resides at the intersection of all of them simultaneously. But it seems to me that there exists a class of entity, potentially what researchers have termed plasmoids, potentially what Keel termed as ultra-terrestrials, potentially what Tibetan Dzogchen describes as base luminosity manifestations, consisting of self-organized electromagnetic field coherence in plasma substrates, capable of consciousness in some form, capable of responsive adaptation to environmental input, capable of coordinated group behavior through shared field coupling, and normally existing, it would appear, outside the narrow band of human visual perception. These entities don't appear to be visitors from elsewhere in space, but are native to Earth's electromagnetic environment, possibly to the interface between the lower atmosphere and the ionosphere, and possibly to a frequency domain that overlaps with but is not identical to conventional electromagnetic reality in the sense that Keel described. The human practitioner, through a specific coherent practice of emotional, logical entrainment, which simultaneously elevates cardiac coherence, increases biophotonic output coherence, generates torsion field disturbance, and potentially stabilizes the orchestrated objective reduction quantum collapse sequence into an ordered intentional pattern, producing a combined field signature of extraordinary distinctiveness relative to background noise, the signal in the noise. This signature carries two types of information simultaneously: the emotional quality of the state, open, positive, inviting, non-threatening, and the logical structure of the intentional content, a request for contact with something of higher consciousness. These are distinguishable to an entity sensitive to both electromagnetic coherence and torsion or quantum gravitational information. These orbs may have even been near the location the whole time, invisible in their normal low emission state, and my practice was a signal that triggered them into visible emission. Or perhaps they do travel to the location from elsewhere in their field domain, attracted by the resonance that they are picking up. I don't think we have any closed answer because the phenomenon does not permit one with current scientific frameworks. What it does permit is the identification of multiple convergent lines of evidence and theory that collectively make the following propositions defensible to a serious, open-minded, intelligent person. The idea that self-organizing plasma or field entities of some form exist in Earth's electromagnetic environment and exhibit intelligence-consistent behavior, that the human body, in a state of conscious coherence, specifically the heart-brain entrainment state associated with sustained positive emotional focus, generates a physically real, informationally rich, electromagnetic photonic field complex that is qualitatively distinguishable from the background physiological noise of reality, registering as a spike that is perceptible to some form of intelligence that appears as orbs. I think the fact that the ancient esoteric traditions, most rigorously the Tibetan Dzogchen system, have mapped encounters with precisely this class of phenomenon through centuries of first-person investigation and have developed theoretical frameworks long before modern science was even a thing, the base luminosity, the toggle light phenomena, the rainbow body, that are convergent with the plasma intelligence and consciousness physics models in ways that can't be explained by coincidence. I think it gives us a real understanding that we should park our prejudice to the side and really take a look at these ancient mystic traditions through the lens of a scientific and logical perspective, but appreciating that they had a real intuition and real insight that they were drawing upon, and of course using their cultural framework to describe it, the rainbow body and, you know, these various terms. But these terms are just terms. The actual phenomena itself is still being described in modern science. So we have to accept that this is a real phenomena and that these people had unique insight into it. Very interesting to me that these people had the ability to perceive and articulate a phenomena that modern science is only just now grappling with. I don't believe that my sightings were random. I do think it was a form of communication. I think it may be the beginning of a communication. And it's been a number of years since I've actively engaged in trying to actually have these types of events. And a lot of people will say to you, you know, why didn't you film these experiences when they were happening to you? And I totally get that. And if you don't want to believe me, fine. But you really think I'd be investing this much time? I mean, my God, my throat is so sore after doing this whole talk where I've dived into all of the possible avenues that I think might be able to explain some element of this. Like, do you really think I'd be doing that if I was just bullshitting you about them? I have no need to do that. They did happen to me. They were the reason why I started Project Unity in the first place, and I'm doing everything I'm doing now because these experiences happened to me. But a lot of people say, well, why didn't you film it? And frankly, I wasn't going out at this point in my life to show the world. I wasn't going out to prove a point to a debunker. I wasn't going out to gather evidence for anyone other than myself. I wasn't thinking in those terms. I decided to create a YouTube channel and become a public researcher after the fact, right? So I wasn't actually in the state of mind where I thought I want to capture evidence. I was actually in, you know, a relatively fragile time. It was a difficult time. I was going through things. I was thinking very deeply about reality. I wanted answers to very strong fundamental questions. And so it was a very personal experience. And, you know, something that I can't remember who said this. I think it was a very wise man who said it. That the more you talk about experiences like this to the public, the more you talk about it to people and explain it, the less real it becomes or the less magical it becomes. And there is a level of truth to that. You know, I've had to go through the ringer of, you know, talking about the orbs experience over and over and people saying, oh, it's bullshit, I don't believe you, whatever. And it's like, dude, I don't care. I know that this is the most transformative moment that I've had in my life so far, right? I know that these experiences put me on the path I'm on now. So I don't really give a fuck if people don't believe me. I'm more interested in people that, even if you're skeptical, are still actively trying to understand if there's some merit to it. And I hope that throughout this video, I've provided at least some level of evidentiary pathway where you're like, ah, actually, you know what? Like, it's not all just airy-fairy magic nonsense. Like, there is some form of tangible line, some anchor into observable science. And that's what excites me, because it's not just New Age rhetoric. It's not just New Age rhetoric. But funnily enough, the New Age rhetoric, a lot of it is correct. It's just it doesn't have much substance to it, right? It's just kind of like, you know, statements like, oh, yeah, this and that. It's like, okay, yeah, but do something with that, right? Like, make something with that. Because I'm a logic guy. There are children screaming outside right now. I'm pretty sure they're just happy. Anyway, I wasn't trying to film these events. I was doing this for myself. And when they occurred, I mean, sometimes I did have my phone in my pocket. On a couple of these occasions, I'm sure I had my phone in my pocket. But you, unless you've experienced something like this, where it's a complete paradigm shift change from your reality, you do not think normally. You don't think rationally. And you don't start going, okay, right, well, I need to get my phone out. Oh, I've been blinded by my screen. I can't really see, but let me get my unlock. Let me put my passcode in and navigate to my camera and point it up. No, like none of that enters your mind whatsoever because it's so novel. It's so weird. You stare at it and that's it. You're done. You're staring. That's, I mean, for me at least for these experiences that I had, all I could actually do was stare at them each time. Just like, oh my God. Oh my God, there it is again. Like, they're coming by. They're coming by in a formation. When they came down from the sky, I was just shocked, like literally just frozen in place, staring. Like, I actually feel embarrassed about it, you know, because I was putting out all of these coherent signals and like, you know, I want to communicate. I want to connect. I want something to arrive. I'm ready. I want to see you. Then they turn up and I'm just like, duh. It's like, oh, wow. Thanks, human. We just came here thinking we were going to get an intellectual conversation for a change. And nope, just another monkey, you know, staring at him like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is actually happening. It's true that you won't respond the way that you normally think you would respond in a situation that's completely abnormal, right? You get frozen in place and that's how it works, unfortunately. And it's been a long time since I've tried to do that kind of contact stuff again. I'm not necessarily saying that you should go out and do it, but it is real. I do think that they represent some form of, if not benevolent, at the very least benign form of intelligence. I don't believe they're malevolent, demonic, manipulative, as a lot of people like to say. At least in my case, I didn't feel manipulated whatsoever. It just provided me with a platform upon which I was able to understand, at least to my perspective, a higher degree of reality. A new piece of reality was given to me. Orbs of light that respond to conscious signals exist. Do with that information what you will, Jay. You know what I mean? And I did. I went off into the forest, put a camera up on a tree branch and said, hello, world. I had experiences and I'm still trying to understand them. And, you know, what do you think about them? And that was the beginning of Project Unity. At this point, I've gone through all the science and the esoteric and the mystic and my experiences, and I'm just kind of babbling at you. If you're still watching, I'd really appreciate it if you hit the subscribe button, if you haven't done that already. It's a big help, and a lot of you don't actually subscribe and you still watch my videos. Very cheeky of you. Just give it a little tickle. It's not going to hurt you. I'm going to be off in a couple of days to Colorado. I'm speaking at a conference out in Colorado called the Snippy Conference. I think they call it Snippy after Snippy the horse. You know that whole like drama with Snippy the horse? I barely know what that means because I'm English, but I do know that there was a controversy with a horse called Snippy that I think got put down or something happened, right? I think the conference is named after that. I'm not really quite sure why. Either way, it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. It's UFOs, ancient history, consciousness, all the kind of things that we know and love. So I'm looking forward to flying out to Colorado. Never been to Colorado before. That's one of the states I haven't visited. Colorado is my kind of place. Mountains and forests and rivers and climbing and hiking and mountain biking. Like, that's my kind of jam. So really looking forward to going there. And then I'm off to Georgia for a podcast, which will be coming out. And the big plan this year, hopefully, will be Japan. Later in the fall, I want to go out to Japan. We're going to do a lot of filming with Jeffrey Drum that I did out in Egypt. Remember Jeffrey Drum? He is a fantastic researcher. He splits his time between Egypt and Japan, kind of like 6 months in one, 6 months in the other. And so just like we did in Egypt, where we met up with him, went out to Saqqara, went out to the Giza Plateau, the Serapeum, we're going to go out to Japan and film some of the megalithic prehistoric structures and very strange stonework that litters that particular countryside. And I think this is going to be a particularly cinematic ancient technologies docu-series because it's, well, I sort of, it's Japan. It's Japan. It's going to look insane. It's going to look amazing. So yeah, really excited to head out to Japan and get all of that filmed for you guys. In the meantime, you just stay safe out there. Crazy world and all that. We'll get through it together.